Welcome, everyone. I'm Richard Krause. I hope you're staying happy, healthy, and safe. It's a big show, so let's get right at it. Later on, we'll meet Christian Sparks, a film director and screenwriter from St. John's, Newfoundland and Labrador. His new movie, The King Tide, is set in an isolated, struggling community 10 years after a child with miraculous gifts washed up on the beach. She's able to heal people, but after a decade of prosperity, her adoptive parents are forced to decide whether her safety is more important than their community's prosperity. It's intriguing, and it's a little bit later on. We'll also meet the award-winning former Toronto Star journalist Morgan Campbell. His new memoir, My Fighting Family, Borders and Bloodlines and the Battles That Made Us, offers a history of his family's multi-generational battles, a coming-of-age story, and a powerful reckoning with what it means to be Black in Canada when you have strong American roots. First, though, let's get to know Ruth Reichel, the New York Times bestselling author of 5 memoirs, the novel Delicious, and the cookbook My Kitchen Year. She was editor-in-chief of Gourmet magazine and previously served as restaurant critic for the New York Times, as well as food editor and restaurant critic for the Los Angeles Times. She has been honored with 6 James Beard Awards. Today, we'll talk about her new book, the Paris novel, which follows Stella St. Vincent, an introverted 30-something who finds purpose in a search for art, fashion, and food on a 1983 Paris trip. Ruth Reichel joined me via Zoom from New York. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.
Now, you have said, I usually hate writing and will find windows to wash, laundry to fold, ovens to clean, anything to avoid staring at a blank screen. I think that's probably common with a lot of writers. I know it certainly is with me. But about the Paris novel, you say, the truth is almost everything about this book makes me happy. Writing it was a pure pleasure. So what was the difference between wanting to jump away and do almost anything else and sit in front of your computer and writing this book?
You know, if I knew what the magic about this was, I would make sure it always happened. But right. With this book, you know, when I first wrote fiction, my last book, I had the fantasy that writing fiction would be like reading fiction. Mm-hmm. And with that book, it wasn't. For some reason, with this book, I literally went to Paris every day. When I went into my office and opened up my computer, I would say to my family, I'm going to Paris now. And it really felt like that. I mean, I sort of had an out-of-body experience, which I've never had before, writing, where I was just living this book. And it was so much fun that I was very reluctant to finish it. I mean, I worked on it longer than I think I needed to.
Well, sometimes it's hard to let things go. I know I've changed one of my books between its first and second printing because I wasn't ready to let it go. So.
Oh, that has not happened to me yet.
I don't advise it as a way moving forward. Tell me a little bit about what you would have picked up from your years as a journalist, your years as a memoirist, that would apply to you writing fiction. This is your second fiction novel. What did you learn that informed the work that you're doing now?
Well, a lot of what I learned as a journalist was how to do research. And you know, when you're writing fiction, I mean, one of the pleasurable parts about it for someone who hates to write is doing the research. And I can go down rabbit holes forever. And it was the same with this book. I mean, and then I had something sort of magical happen as I was researching this book. But, you know, I mean, I was researching Paris in the time of Manet because one of my character becomes enamored of Manet's Olympia. And I started doing a lot of research into the Paris of the 1850s, although this book is set in the 1980s. But the other thing is that I actually was in Paris a lot in the 1980s. And I had notes, I mean, the kind of journalistic notes that you would have. So, for instance, every meal in this book is actually a meal that I ate in Paris at one point in my life.
Wow. And did going through those notes open up an avenue of your imagination that perhaps may have stayed closed otherwise?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I found myself in a fictional mode, imagining the perfect way to taste. And my character, who is a very repressed young woman, and, you know, Paris sort of teaches her how to be alive and how to experience the world. And having the note, these sort of dry notes, I ate this, this, and this, I mean, to imagine what someone who has never allowed herself to appreciate food, to enjoy food, who in fact has never allowed herself pleasure of any kind, to have the journal, you know, the notes of a newspaper writer, and then to imagine what would it be like really to be tasting this for the first time, and how, what it would feel like to open yourself up to actually not just food, but, you know, art, music, literature. I mean, she is sort of experimenting. She's, you know, in her early 30s, but in many ways, the world is very new for her.
You're listening to Ruth Rochelle on The Richard Krause Show. Her new novel, The Paris Novel, is available wherever fine books are sold.
Having these very sort of, you know, dry notes about what I was experiencing as I'm walking through Paris in the 80s, and then trying to imagine it as someone who is really coming alive for the first time, I think that's part of what the joy of this book was for me, that I got to feel what Stella is feeling. And of course, I'm a very different person than she is.
Well, it's an interesting character arc for Stella to, and must be interesting to write about, someone who starts in one place and ends up in a completely different place, learns a lot about life and love and food and everything. Tell me a little bit about imagining her as we first meet her, as someone who is kind of repressed, is introverted, who doesn't really have the kind of life that perhaps you would have had when you were visiting Paris in the 1980s.
Yeah, she's had this very traumatic childhood, and her response to it is to close up, to make the world safe for herself. Mm-hmm. She makes her world very small. And that isn't hard for me to imagine. You know, I think opening yourself to adventure is something that's a little difficult for all of us. And I was just able to imagine it on a grand scale. I mean, what is it like to be really so afraid of the world that you have to do the same things over and over and never allow yourself any joy, because that's the only way that you can feel safe. And but she's very bright, and she's, you know, she's not a child. She's very well read. She's very disciplined. She has taught herself a lot about art. And so she comes to the world in a way that I think many of us would love to, you know, where when you're a mature person, suddenly everything becomes open. And, you know, she's never even really had friends before. So she's making friends for the first time. And she's experiencing, I mean, you know, she goes and lives at Shakespeare and Company, the bookstore. And this is something that over the years, 30,000 people have actually lived in that bookstore.
Is that true? It's not big.
It's not big. And, but, you know, the remarkable man who opened that store, George Whitman, he had a sign of generosity of spirit that he thought, you know, everybody who likes books, if they don't have a place to stay, they can curl up in the corner somewhere here. And Stella does that. And she, who has, like, you know, lived in her head, is suddenly, you know, she has a community of people, which she has never had before. And they look out for each other. And And then she's meeting the great writers of the time. I mean, she meets James Baldwin and John Ashbery, and everybody is kind to her. I mean, I do think that what happens when you have someone like that is that everybody feels protective of her once they get to know her.
This started off in a way as a chapter in your book, Save Me the Plums, and your editor, Susan Camel, said, "I love the Paris chapter. Give me more of that, please." Susan has since passed away. Is this a gift to her? Does it make it feel special in a way that your other books perhaps don't?
I mean, I wrote this book very much for Susan, who passed away just as I was beginning it. I mean, she really said, you know, I had this real experience, and she said, "Couldn't you imagine a bigger story from your very small experience with this fabulous black dress?" And so Susan was kind of sitting on my shoulder as I was writing this book. And everybody at Random House, I mean, Susan was a legendary editor. I mean, she, for her memorial, I mean, you know, Salman Rushdie spoke. She was beloved by many of us. And, you know, everybody at Random House said to me, "Susan would be so happy with this book. She would love this book." And, you know, that gives me great joy, although it makes me extremely sad that she'll never get to read it.
The Paris novel is set in 1983. You were there in the 80s. Your adventures were much different than Stella's.
Yes, they were very different than Stella's. But why I chose 1983 was, one, because I have this older man, this old man who Stella meets, and I wanted to be able to bring his experiences, which are from pre-World War I and II Paris. And I, so I wanted to sort of be able to mine the entire 20th century. But also because the franc was very low at the time, the dollar was very strong. I mean, in 1983, you could, and I did, go to Paris on $2 a day. I mean, if you were frugal, you could really be there on very little money. And also for me personally, I got my first real job. I was a freelance writer until 1984 when I went to the LA Times. It was the first time I ever had an expense account. So I have chosen that year when I went from someone who could only afford to spend $2 a day in Paris to someone who was really eating my first 3-star meals. So it's a time that I think it was a wonderful time for an American to be in Paris. I mean, in many ways, kind of a repeat of the Paris of the 20s when, you know, Hemingway and Fitzgerald were there. A Paris that is very different from modern Paris, a kind of romantic Paris. And so I am sort of mining my own experiences as, you know, someone who actually saw that high-end Paris that Jules is introducing Stella to for the first time in that moment.
You have written a number of books, but mainly I know you as a magazine and newspaper writer and journalist. Tell me if there is one that you prefer, or if they are both sort of equal in a way, just that the results are different.
No, there. I love collaborative work. I mean, I for me, the great joy of being the editor of Gourmet Magazine was that it was a project we did together. And I'm also very social. So, I mean, I think that's one reason why writing is generally hard for me. I mean, I don't like being all by myself in an office. I love being surrounded by lots of people. And I love what happens when you take an idea and you bounce it off someone else and they have a better idea. And, you know, I mean, watching the issues we put together at Gourmet, I mean, because it really was so collaborative, where every issue got better and stronger with every meeting that we had, where someone would say, you know, what if we take that article from the issue we have planned 2 months from now and put it in this, because, and watching that growing and it's a wonderful process. And I loved working in a newspaper newsroom too. You know, when I went from being a freelance writer who was more or less alone to being in, you know, the excitement of an urban newsroom, it's pretty great. And I have to say, it's kind of dying. I mean, as we're all now, I mean, post-COVID, as everybody's now working from home.
You're listening to Ruth Reichshaw on the Richard Krause Show. Her new novel, The Paris Novel,
Zoom meetings
is available
and that sort of thing
wherever fine books are sold.
I mean, when I was a gourmet, I felt like my job really was just to be there and walk around the office. Right. Because people will say something in a meeting. They're careful in a meeting. But when you're actually having a conversation, people will tell you what they really think. Yeah. You know, so someone who wouldn't hazard that in a big group of people, you just, you know, walk into their office and sit down and start talking. New creative things happen.
You have talked about the healing power of work.
Well, look, you know, I am probably the first generation of women who were expected to work.
Right.
And I grew up with, surrounded by older women who were very smart, very well educated, and weren't allowed to work. So I have always thought that working is the greatest thing. I mean, I think it's where you get your sense of self-worth. And I don't even care what kind of work it is. I mean, when I had a restaurant, I was bussing tables. Just the idea that you will do that job to your best ability. You know, the notion that you are doing something well, I think gives you enormous satisfaction. And the idea that, you know, I feel sorry for people who don't work. I mean, I will never not work.
Perhaps they just didn't love it as much as you do.
Well, that's true. And I have to say, I've been very lucky. I have only done work that I would basically do for free.
Well, you've owned a restaurant, as you say, but for many years you were a critic. Often you were in disguise. And you've said that you found that lots of restaurants don't do customer service very well. And I'm interested in that. I worked in the hospitality business for many years. I was a bartender and a waiter, and I ran bars and did all that sort of thing for a very long time while I was paying the bills so that I could afford to do the other stuff that I wanted to do. And I agree with you. I agree with you. I think customer service is not hard, and yet so many people don't seem to be able to get it right. So what do you think the key for a business in terms of customer service is?
Well, I think, I mean, for specifically in the hospitality business, for restaurant business, I think restaurants need to remember that nobody goes out to eat. People go out for dozens of reasons, and the food is part of it. But people go out to feel good, to get away from their homes, and they want a lot from a restaurant that isn't food. And you know, if you walk into a restaurant and they keep you waiting for 45 minutes, they're rude about it. They can then give you manna from heaven, and it's not going to matter because the evening is ruined already. On the other hand, if you walk in and they say, "I'm so sorry, your table, you know, these people won't leave. We don't know what to do. We've offered them free desserts." If they're nice, you know, can we get you a drink? If they apologize about it, it's fine. I mean, it's you don't have to go to giant lengths. You just have to treat people as if you care about them.
I agree. And I often say that bars in specific, not just restaurants, but I'm thinking bars. I like a good dive bar. I like a good place that is strictly just going to for a drink. And I say that they are the last democratic place that we have. For the price of a draft, you can sit next to anyone that comes in. They could be a judge. They could be the guy that asks for money on the street. It could be anybody. And you can have a conversation. It's the last truly democratic place.
And the proof of how much we want that was COVID.
Yep.
Because, you know, what we missed wasn't the food in restaurants. We could get it. What we missed was that sort of wonderful thing that you're going to go in and you don't know what's going to happen, but something wonderful could happen. You could meet someone, you know, just sitting at a bar who will be a lifelong friend. I mean, we are animals who love to be around other people, and we love to be around people that we don't necessarily know. It's in the DNA. I totally agree with you.
That was Ruth Rachel. Find her book, The Paris Novel, wherever you buy fine books. Help me welcome the award-winning former Toronto Star journalist Morgan Campbell. His new memoir, My Fighting Family, Borders and Bloodlines and the Battles That Made Us, offers a history of his family's multi-generational battles, a coming-of-age story, and a powerful reckoning with what it means to be Black in Canada when you have strong American roots. It's a fascinating book, and he's a fascinating guy. Here's Morgan Campbell, who joined me via Zoom. As a journalist, you get trained to avoid using the word I, generally speaking, in your writing. But here you're asking a big question. You're asking, who am I? So yeah. Tell me about this shift then in moving from one form to the memoir form.
Yeah, it was difficult because as a journalist, especially doing the type of work that I like doing, in the sense that, you know, people know me as a feature writer and someone who not only can write, but can research and interview and observe and get people to say things that they might not otherwise think they were going to say or might not otherwise have been comfortable saying, make people comfortable with you so they can reveal things about themselves that you can then put out in a story. And after a while, I'm not going to say it was easy, but I was used to doing that with other people. But it was a different task doing that with myself, being honest with myself, being fearless, but also vulnerable on the page. It is a challenge. Mm-hmm. Like the other skills, though, they still come into play, like how to turn a phrase, observation.
I love your way with detail here.
Okay.
And that comes from your journalism practice and from maybe just, you know, your general life. You notice things. And my favorite moments in movies are all about scenes where it seems like nothing much is happening, but there will be one line or a look or something that tells you everything you need to know about the situation or the character or whatever it is. And as I was reading this, I thought of Pete, who
My dad.
Yeah, who hated the smell of Kentucky bourbon.
Yes.
It's sick. And you don't really need any more than that, because you know that it's the kind of bourbon that his father drank. And all of a sudden, it tells you, it paints that picture. But it's such a beautiful little detail.
Yeah. And so there are a lot of things I was trying to accomplish with this book and the way I wanted to put it together. And one of the things I really wanted to do, because I tried to sit down and write this as one straight narrative and it nearly broke my brain. And so I broke it down into like chapters, sort of like album songs in an album, but also really wanted to just, instead of a painting, have like a mosaic, right? And build this story just on the steady accretion of these details. Because these details I include, I could have included in any order, but I included them in the order I included them on purpose. So this thing about my dad hating the smell of Kentucky bourbon, you know, and he mentioned that like in passing to someone. And he said, because his dad drank it. Now, that detail could have come in almost any chapter, right? Could have come in the chapter where it's my dad and I rolling through Chicago talking about his dad. But I chose to use that to foreshadow. My dad smells the Kentucky bourbon. He hates the smell of Kentucky bourbon. Why does he hate the Kentucky bourbon? I mentioned why he does. And if I'd left it there, you know, the reader would have been unfulfilled. But there's a whole chapter later on that explores the idea that I bring up in that chapter. But yeah, I did try to pay attention to detail because I want to build this story on details.
Well, and the details are the thing that brings it to life, right? And that, for me anyway, was just so kind of vibrant. You know, it was so, because it's not like he didn't drink. He drank beer. He would drink
right. things. Yeah.
It was just this one very specific thing that you know, brought back flashbacks for him, which, you know, were troubling to him. So it's a great little moment that feels to me like a huge moment when your eye scans across it in the book.
Right. It's and the same thing about my mom, you know, walking around with a wooden spoon in her purse.
Yeah.
Just in case she had to light one of us up when we were out shopping, we started acting up.
You're listening to Morgan Campbell on The Richard Krause Show. His new book, My Fighting Family, Borders and Bloodlines and the Battles That Made Us, is available wherever fine books are sold.
You talk to anyone that knows me, you talk to my sisters, you say, tell the story of growing up with my mom, you have to mention the wooden spoon at some point. It's just a question of when. And right, so that when I left till, you know, later in the book.
You're listening to Morgan Campbell on The Richard Krause Show. His new memoir, My Fighting Family, Borders and Bloodlines and the Battles That Made Us, is available now wherever fine books are sold. What kind of research do you do, or do you do any? I mean, memoirs are based on memory, but they're also involving, there's extended family that we're talking about here. It's not just simply your story. It's the story of a lot of people. So Do you have to do a lot of digging?
Sort of. So a lot of these stories are like family stories, but you do have to kind of cross-reference them with older people, especially the stuff that happened before I was born. I got to cross-reference a lot of that stuff with my mom and my aunt. You know, I did have to do some research in terms of just details, you know, because sometimes there's things you think you remember, and then you have to double check it to see if it actually happened that way, or if that's just your memory. You know, the tricky thing here is that, you know, I come from a family of very opinionated people, and we all have the way we think things should be, the way we think things went down, the way we think things should go down. So the danger here is like involving them too much along too much of the process is you open yourself up to every single person in the family trying to get you to write the book that they would have written, which wouldn't fly. You know, but some of these things and some of these details I learned in the cross-referencing, in the sense that and hopefully, you know, your audience will go out and buy this book and read it, but like, and there'll be context for what I'm about to say, but like when the mob enforcer offers to kill my grandparents' next door neighbors.
I was going to ask you about that. So Claude Jones is the character, right? He is such a vividly painted character here. And when I read that part, I thought, I don't know whether this is true or not, but it kind of didn't matter to me because it spoke to who he was. It spoke to this colorful life that he had led.
Yeah, no.
It could be true.
That part was true. I think the only question is the extent to which the mob enforcer meant it.
Right.
But that happened. But so when he would tell that story, he would just always fast forward to the punchline, and it really wasn't important who the mob enforcer was. He didn't even tell us it was a mob enforcer. He would just tell the story of a mob guy. But I read it by my mom. My mom was like, no, that wasn't just a mob guy. That was a mob enforcer. And it wasn't just a mob enforcer. It was the premier mob enforcer of Chicago of that era, Marshal Caifano. If you Google him, you will find all kinds of stuff. None of it very flattering. This man had a reputation. So if he says, hey, I'll kill your next door neighbors, he might very well mean it. And even if he's joking about it, like, what a thing to joke about. It's macabre, just in a different way.
What were the conversations with your family like as you were starting this to write this book?
They were supportive and curious. And, you know, for my mom and like my aunt and my sisters, they get it in the sense that I'm writing these stories from my point of view. I had to, you know, write this email to my family the other day just to remind them and warn them that this is all stuff from my point of view. your points of view on these fights might be different, and that's okay. I'm not trying to relitigate any of this stuff, because the one thing I want people to take away from this, one of the things I want people to take away from this is that, like, in these family fights, nobody wins. There is no winner, right? All you do is waste time and waste energy. My mom and my aunt got it. Like, and if they had written the story, there would be a lot more of their mother. But there wasn't a lot of my grandmother, my mom's mom, because the big characters in this book besides me are, my mom, my dad, my dad's mom, and my mom's dad. Mm-hmm. And so, as the book circulates through my family and people get to reading it, if they have questions, they can ask me, but I've already explained to them, like, where I was coming from.
That was Morgan Campbell, author of the memoir, My Fighting Family, Borders and Bloodlines and the Battles That Made Us. It's available now wherever fine books are sold. In this segment, we'll meet Christian Sparks, a film director and screenwriter from St. John's, Newfoundland and Labrador. I really like his revenge thriller, Hammer, the story of a father who faces a personal crisis when he discovers his estranged son fleeing a botched drug deal. It's good stuff and likely available on a streamer near you. Today we talk about his new movie, The King Tide. Set in Newfoundland and Labrador, it tells the story of an isolated, struggling community 10 years after a child with miraculous gifts washes up on the beach. She's able to heal people, but after a decade of prosperity, her adoptive parents are forced to decide whether her safety is more important than the community's prosperity. I spoke with Christian Sparks at the most recent Toronto International Film Festival, where the film premiered in the Platform Prize program.
Isla isn't just a gifted child.
Sina.
Many thanks to you, Isla.
She's much greater than that.
Many thanks to you, Isla.
She was delivered to us on this island on the eve of the King Tide.
Congratulations on the film.
Thanks so much.
So there seems to be an element of magical realism in any film that you make in Newfoundland. This is the second one you've shot down there. Is it just, you're from Newfoundland, is it inherent in the storytelling of Newfoundland and Labrador?
I think so, yeah. I think there's kind of like there's a rich history of kind of Gothic folklore that is present in Newfoundland. It's present in the literature and the songwriting. I mean, that often happens in remote places, with nothing to do during the cold winters. You have a lot of great storytellers, tales about kind of fairies and shipwrecks and all of these things. So I'm sure that has little by little over the years maybe been ingrained into my consciousness and comes out in the films.
When I was watching the film, I assumed that you had written it, being from Nova Scotia, but not. Albert Chin wrote the script. Yes. So tell me about the evolution of that. Did he come to you with that, or was it a collaboration?
It's actually, there were two original writers, Ryan and I believe Kevin, approached Will Woods from Woods Entertainment to develop this script, and Will started working with them. And over time, Will became the lead writer, and Albert came on to work with Will. Mm. And Albert was going to direct it, actually, for quite a long period of time, almost up to about 6 months out from shooting. And so they'd been working on that closely together. And for personal issues, Albert had to drop out. And so I got the call. And it fit very much into the wheelhouse of work that I had made before. Again, as you mentioned, had that kind of fantasy drama elements to it, and it takes place in Newfoundland. And so I know the culture and the people of that place so well, mm-hmm. so it seemed like a natural fit. It was a new experience for me. I'm used to writing and developing projects myself, but I could get used to it. I mean, to teach. For someone to say, here's a script, here's the money, show up and do it, and it's a good script, I'm like, yeah, I liked it.
Tell me a little bit about how you came to this project, because typically you've written and directed the films that you've made. This one was a different path.
Yeah, it was kind of a nice change of pace. I'm used to kind of slaving over the computer, spending multiple years, and to be someone say, "Here's a great script. Would you like to direct it? Come in." It was a refreshing change. I could get used to it. It was written by two original writers who worked with Will Woods. He commissioned them to write a script. They had spent time in Newfoundland and come up with this idea. It changed hands over time. Will became one of the main writers with Albert Shin, yeah. who's a really gifted filmmaker and a great guy. And Albert was actually attached to direct it for the longest time, up till about 6 months out from shooting. And then for personal reasons, Albert had to drop out, and I got the call. And obviously being a film set in Newfoundland, I know the people and the culture extremely well. This is my fourth feature now. Three of them take place in Newfoundland. So I think it was a good match of material and director. And so far so good. People seem to like it.
And you shot in a remote town that only has 20 or 30 people in it. Tell me a little bit about that, because it's beautiful on film, absolutely incredible looking. Yeah. But if you blow a light or something breaks down, yes, you've got to travel to get a replacement. So are there challenges that come with that?
Oh, it's extremely challenging shooting, yeah. So like you said, Kiehl's has 20 to 30 people, and that's like peak summer. In Newfoundland, that's like in its heyday. There's probably only a dozen people living there. And it's a working fishing community. Yeah. You know, that's how people make their living there.
You're listening to Christian Sparks on The Richard Crouse Show. His film, The King Tide, is in a theater near you.
So, you know, it's very difficult to even just simple logistics like housing and feeding people suddenly becomes very difficult, very expensive, and very kind of time consuming. Same with if a camera goes down or if a lens goes down. Not only do you need to get something new, but it needs to come from, it needs to be shipped in. So it wasn't without its challenges, but it's also, it makes up for it in its beauty. Mm-hmm. And there's a wonder to this place that really informs the film, informs the story, and looks great on camera. So I actually think it was a blessing. It's worth the pain.
It's not just the beautiful scenery, though. There is something that you cannot fake about the power of that landscape and the ocean. And I grew up on an ocean, and early on when that happens, you learn to have great respect for the power of it. And you feel that in this movie. It's a character in the film almost.
Yeah, I mean, in all the films I've made in Newfoundland, the landscape, as you say, is a character. It's an integral part to the story. I mean, you know, you grew up on the East Coast.
Yeah.
It informs who you are, you know, and I think in a good way. And it makes the story unique, and that's what we're all looking for in film. I mean, you know, Del Toro has this great line, a story that happens anywhere matters nowhere. And I don't think that's always true, but it's a great rule of thumb to go by. So the more specificity you can bring, and in this case, the specificity of a small town Newfoundland, I think it only improves the story.
It is a very specific story, but I think that the more specific you make this story, the more universal it becomes, because really it's about parents protecting a child. It is about isolationism a little bit, but it's about things that people can understand. It is fantasy in a lot of ways, but there's a very human heart beating during this story that I think people will relate to.
I think so too. It's always, you know, trying to balance the human element and the genre elements are always a challenge.
Yeah.
You know, but I think the genre elements, most good genre films always have more on their mind than they let on.
Right.
You know, they're very busy entertaining you, and like they have a propulsive nature, especially thrillers. That's something I feel like I've been pretty good at in the past, and something I've gravitated towards. But there's a lot of rich themes at the core of the film. While people are busy being entertained, they don't realize that the film is kind of, you know, trafficking some very like interesting existential ideas, and hopefully they can discuss that when the film ends.
What is it about that kind of genre that draws you in? Growing up in Newfoundland, you're a little bit isolated. Mm-hmm. Were you a voracious reader of fantasy and science fiction and that kind of thing? What was it?
Not really. When I grew up, I wasn't big into sci-fi and fantasy overly. I was always big into painting and drawing and art. My father was a really talented, well-known Newfoundland artist, so he had me and my brothers entering poster contests at a young age. And I realize now it's actually gave me the foundation to be the filmmaker I am, because he taught me at a really young age, there's a contest coming up, you need to come up with the idea, you need to execute it, and you need to meet it by that deadline.
Right.
And I did that a bunch by the time I was like 10, 12. So when it came to movies, I think I had that strong backbone. But in terms of fantasy itself, it's funny, you know, I don't know why I make what I make. I don't really watch fantasy films. I don't really gravitate towards them, but it seems to come out of my work. So that's for my therapist to figure out.
That was Christian Sparks, director of the new film, The King Tide, which is playing at a theater near you. Big thanks to Christian for stopping by today. Also a big thanks to Morgan Campbell. Check out his new memoir, My Fighting Family, Borders and Bloodlines and the Battles That Made Us. A big thanks to Ruth Reichel. Her book, The Paris Novel, already a bestseller, is available now wherever you buy fine books. Of course, as always, my biggest thanks goes to you for listening. I'm Richard Crouse. Stay happy, stay healthy, stay safe, stay weird, and we'll talk to you again soon.